You're listening to Ride Along, EMT School. I'm Mike.
And I'm Max. We're two students navigating EMT school, bringing you along week by week.
And I'm Jonathan, a paramedic bringing real-world perspective.
Join us as we share the lessons, challenges, and stories from EMT school, and hear insights from those already living the EMS life. Welcome to the Ride Along. Oh, yeah. Kickstart my heart, baby.
Exactly.
Episode 16.
Welcome, everybody.
Welcome, everyone, to the Ride Along EMT School podcast. Thank you for joining us. We're back for episode 16.
Thank you for listening and for hopefully interacting.
Yes. You should interact. As a matter of fact, there's a link in the bio. You can click there. You can go to all the different places that are related to the EMT School podcast.
I'd like to reinforce an offer that if you buy us a monster, Mike will sing your song request. So just make sure you put your note in the purchase so we know what you want him to sing.
I will accept most Billy Joel requests.
No Billy Joel. They will be just...
No, I've got stipulations. Like, you know, I can handle most Billy Joel songs, maybe a little Metallica. Creed. I will definitely sing some Creed for all y'all. But yeah, so if you really are looking for that, go right ahead. You could also request Jonathan to cite deaf poetry jams.
Ooh.
For Max.
Oh, I could do that.
What can we request Max to do?
I'll break something.
He can do interpretive dance.
Yes.
Yes.
I'll do interpretive
dance. You can buy us a monster and request any one of those three things.
The main thing is don't regret your request. You can't complain about your request after the fact. So just
There's no refunds.
There's no refunds.
Yeah, we don't give refunds.
But yeah, so welcome everybody. We're talking about the heart.
We are cardiac emergencies.
Yep. Yep. The bad things that can happen to probably the, well, I wanted to say the most important, you know, part of the body, but they're all pretty important.
They're all very important.
Yeah. You can, as a matter of fact, I would say it is not the most important. And here's why. Because first of all, it can be replaced.
It can be.
You can't replace other things. Like you can't replace a brain. Right? The brain is you, but the heart, it's just really integral to the rest of the system. It's kind of
it's the plumbing. It's the main force of the plumbing. So, you know, those things can be fixed, repaired, and replaced.
It's the industrial complex, right? It's a place where everything needs to be routed to and back out. Exactly. Like blood is pretty essential to, like the brain can't survive without blood.
It's true.
But the heart is replaceable. Although, man, that's probably a topic for another thing, but that's got to be pretty incredible, the idea of replacing a heart. But we're talking about the things that might lead up to needing a new one of those.
Exactly.
So talking about cardiac emergencies, the quote-unquote heart attack, you know, other cardiac emergencies that might exist, but that's the big one, I think, is the heart attack, right?
Yeah.
You know, working too hard can give you a heart attack. You ought to know by now.
Again, buy us a monster.
And if you can't drive with a broken back, at least you can polish the fender. It seems such a waste of time, but if that's what it's all about, mama, okay. I'm moving out. Yeah, so I promised a Billy Joel reference in the last episode.
Please, song request to avoid that aren't Billy Joel. Unless you don't like me, that's the case, and like pile them on.
Listen, man, I love Anthony's song is one of my favorite Billy Joel songs of all time, mainly because my dad's name is Anthony, and I find it very, you know, it's he grew up in New York. It's kind of his thing. Love that song.
I think Billy Joel, but it's Peter Gabriel. For the longest time, like
those don't sound anything alike.
Well, that's what my brain went to.
Mm. Mm. Okay, well, you're uncultured. That's fine. All right, so let's start things off where we normally do.
Yes.
Our medical term of the week. We can set the idea of a key term that brings us through the rest of the episode, and one that we may refer back to several times. This week, it is. the acute coronary syndrome.
What is that?
Well, the acute coronary syndrome, or acute coronary syndrome, is it's a group of conditions that are categorized by a sudden reduced amount of blood flow to the tissue of the heart. Not the blood that's flowing through the heart, right? The heart pumps blood, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But this is something I didn't grasp as a kid because I'm like, oh, the heart, the blood goes into the heart, comes out of the heart, right? But a lot of, like, it's hard to understand that the heart itself also has blood vessels mm-hmm. on it. It has arteries that go to the heart. So the blood comes out of the heart, goes to the aorta, and then from the aorta comes back to the heart through the tinier blood vessels on the outside of the heart. And those are the coronary arteries. So acute coronary syndrome is a blockage in one of those arteries that supply the actual tissue of the heart muscle, with perfusion,
mm-hmm.
right? So it doesn't get blood just from what it pumps through, although that would be that would probably way be the most efficient way of doing it, like if it just leaked into the heart.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it comes out of the heart, goes to the main trunk, and then comes back through a small tiny vessel and then goes around to the outsides of the heart. What those vessels are, I cannot tell you because I do not remember them. I remember one of them is the they call it the widowmaker, right? The right descending artery. I don't know. I'm talking out of my butt now. I don't. Yeah. Some of those things I have a hard time remembering the small details, but it is the coronary arteries, and it is a blockage in one of those coronary arteries. So the three conditions that kind of define ACS: unstable angina, which is a it's a definition for heart pain, like chest pain, but isn't necessarily associated with damage. Angina is one of those things that, like, somebody can be diagnosed with, they can have nitroglycerin for, it's chest pain, and it can often be an early sign of an impending heart attack. Like, somebody's getting angina, they're progressing towards, like, possibly having further ACS issues.
Right.
Then you have your STEMIs. So you have an NSTEMI or a non-STEMI, which stands for non-ST elevation myocardial infarction.
Right.
Mouthful. Myocardial meaning the tissue of the heart, right? And then infarction meaning a stoppage of blood. Is that right, Jonathan? Does that sound?
Yes. A stoppage of oxygenated blood flow
is an infarction.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, a STEMI is like, you know, STEMI is defining the cardiac monitor output, like where you're seeing like the ST waves and the I don't know, like the electrocardiac ECG outputs. Mm-hmm. There are different waves in there. Those different waves signify different parts and views and things happening on the heart in time, but. You know, an elevated section of that graph denotes a heart attack, right? Or denotes a myocardial infarction,
right?
Which is a blockage of the blood going through one of those coronary arteries, which is a problem.
Yes.
Can be a bit of a problem, right? So a partial blockage means that it's a non-ST, a non-STEMI. And then if it has a, and that non-STEMI can lead to some muscle damage, but it's not as damaging as a STEMI, which is an ST elevation myocardial infarction, which is complete blockage of that coronary artery. Like, it is completely occluded, and then that basically leads to full thickness heart muscle damage.
Which they showed slides that was pretty graphic.
Yeah, it's terrible. So basically the heart muscle itself stops perfusing and it gets damaged. Now, it doesn't mean that like all of the heart dies at once, but as those cells stop perfusing in that full thickness of the heart, it stops contracting. Now, other parts of the heart are still contracting, maybe even in areas right next to where the damage is, but it means that overall it's just weakening, 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 right? So the longer that heart attack lasts, the more of that heart muscle that dies, and then all of a sudden then it all dies and it doesn't come back. Once you have dead heart muscle, it's gone.
Yep.
Right?
Right.
So that is a heart attack, when the blood stops flowing to the heart muscle itself.
it's one of the reasons, you know, we have a saying, you know, and this applies in multiple kind of issues where we're reducing blood flow, and reducing, you know, perfusion, but, time is tissue, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So the more time we, waste, or the more time we save, the more tissue we save, or the more tissue we lose. So time is tissue. That's why recognition of ACS is really, really important, and why getting people where they need to go, as far as appropriate facilities and a timely manner, is super important as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing where your STEMI center is, you mm-hmm. know, a heart center, getting yep. them there as quickly as possible, perhaps bypassing other hospitals, because yep. it's important to get that patient into a cath lab, which is a catheterization lab, so that, you know, those cardiologists can really get in there and, like, you know, open that thing up ASAP.
Yep.
Right. Because right. that's definitively the only way to stop.
Right.
Or to get that blood flowing again is to get in there and open the artery back up. So yeah, so that is acute coronary syndrome, and it comes with a few signs and symptoms, which really kind of define a lot of cardiac emergencies. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest one. I mean, it's synonymous with the idea of heart attack or any type of cardiac emergency, pain.
Yep.
Right. Like,
yeah.
There's different, like, kind of categorizations of it, but, like, essentially the biggest one being, they've used this term so many times that I'll never forget mm-hmm. it. And I hear the reason why they use it is because it is so, like, repeated in the world. It's like, I feel like there's an elephant sitting mm-hmm. on my chest.
Yep.
The idea of, like, oh, something is so heavy sitting on there, even though it's not there. That chest pain pressure, that is, like,
yeah,
very closely associated with that type of condition. Sometimes, and I hear it's more associated with males, is the radiating pain that goes down, yeah. like down the arm, to the down the arm or up to the jaw.
Yep.
Maybe even to the lower back. And then, of course, you know, you get some downstream effects, like, you know, shortness of breath, where, okay, the heart may stop. The heart's not producing as much pump as it normally does, so the lungs may start increasing their output to try and compensate, right? Right. So you get the shortness mm-hmm. of breath. You feel like you can't get as much, you know, air in as you want. That could also be indicative, or that can also be from the pain itself mm-hmm. that they're having that short, like, you know, they're just having, you know, anxiety over the situation. That could lead to shortness of breath too. Right. You could start getting nausea, sweating, dizziness, all these kind of classic symptoms, especially yep. the sweating, the diaphoresis, yeah. You know, which obviously means pale, cool, clammy skin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is the one that I found most interesting, though, which I've heard several times, this last mm-hmm. kind of symptom, if you will, of a ACS, the impending sense of doom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Have you seen that in person, Jonathan?
Yes.
Really? Yeah. Okay. Can you?
When? Yeah. On multiple occasions. You know, we talk about our from the door assessment pretty readily, and we talk about, like, sick or not sick, making that determination. These people, you're going to look at them from the door, and you're going to be like, that person's sick. And when you talk to them, they know that they are sick and that they are not doing well. And if somebody says, I feel like I'm going to die, you should believe them
mm-hmm.
And get them to where they need to go as quickly as possible. And if there's interventions you can do, you should do them, because that person is about to circle the drain.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do something,
they're telling you something.
They're telling you something. They know. They know. And, yeah. and you can kind of, like, I have been in some situations where people have been kind of in hysterics because of the stress of a situation and said things like, oh, I feel like I'm going to die. And they're perfectly fine. But when you look at somebody and they've got an ashen color to them, and, you know, they just they look like they're going to die, and they say that, you should believe them. 100%. It's not, that's not the patient to stay on scene and play around with. That's the person you need to load and go as immediately as possible. And, but yeah, it's an eerie feeling to have somebody look at you and say, I feel like I'm going to die, and know how right they are.
Yeah.
If you don't do something.
Yeah. I could imagine, like, I'm sure we'll see that at some point. Cardiac stuff seems to be a staple of,
you know,
basically reasons why people need to go to the hospital. Right. So there's also, some atypical presentations, which usually, well, like we don't necessarily associate them with heart attacks. As a matter of fact, there are whole demographics that we don't necessarily associate with heart attacks. Usually like
women, children,
women don't typically they have them, but in, you know, I guess popular culture, it's always seems like it's men that have them, but women can have them too.
Presentation is so different.
Yeah.
And it's why, it's one of the reasons that a 12 lead or an EKG is in a lot of ways just another vital sign that you should be doing.
Right.
Because of the atypical presentation that a lot of females have when we're talking about myocardial infarctions.
I had a conversation with one of the paramedics at my service, and she was telling me about a story that she had seen. She was at like a rest stop or something like that, where they had pulled in to take care of something else. I think they may have been getting gas, and some woman comes over and she's like, just kind of casually like, "Hey, I don't feel so well. Like my stomach kind of hurts. I've been having some problems." And I was wondering if you would recommend that I go to the hospital. And like, there was like a sixth sense that she said, like, oh, you know, we had a sense that like, we should probably help this lady. Cause who walks up to an ambulance, even though they haven't called 911 and said, "Hey, I don't feel so good." And she's like, "Well, you know, my back hurts." And they're like, "Okay, hon, well, let's bring you in the ambulance. Let's see if it, cause it was a hot day or something like that." And they brought her in and they're like, "Let's see if we could just make you feel a little bit better." And you know, they were hoping it was going to turn into, "We're going to give you a little bit of attention and you cool off a bit and hopefully feel better." And then they hook her up to the 12 lead and she's having a massive STEMI.
Right.
And they're like, the code 3 or whatever the term, lights and sirens, let's roll it. And they were rushing to get to the hospital, and they saved her, but the woman just was like, she was walking. She didn't have any pain. She just felt off. That's how sometimes it can present.
And I mean, in my experience, women generally with pain and things are much tougher than men.
They're generally tougher than us.
So their ability to tolerate it or to ignore it, and from my experience, is better than what you see in guys.
Yeah. So the ACS stuff, it's kind of, you know, ubiquitous to the idea of cardiac emergencies. It all comes from blockage in the coronary arteries. It has those kind of typical, you know, signs and symptoms that you think of for heart attack that's what it is. It's a heart attack, right? The ACS. So that's our term for the week is acute coronary syndrome.
And it leads us right into our topics.
Right. Because there's ways that we, you know, there's other things to look out for, and there's ways to help treat or intervene in those types of cardiac emergencies. And that's what we learned in class, right?
Right.
Is what's out there? What are we going to encounter?
Right.
So it first started, though, with a review, like most of these classes do, of like, hey, let's make sure everyone's on the same page, make sure we're all understanding what this, and that's, I'll be honest, the only reason I actually understand the idea of how the heart needs perfusion, how it needs the coronary arteries, is because we take the time to reiterate those things and to understand. So I appreciate the process of,
yeah, for sure,
of reiterating how the heart works, right?
Well, it's kind of complex. I mean, it really is. Mm-hmm. You know, how it's fed, looking at a diagram of it doesn't really clue you in too well, because you've got these pipes that are going in different directions and going behind each other. So, you know, those reviews, especially in the way that's working, I think are hugely important.
Yeah. And honestly, there's sometimes, you know, instructors that do a better job than others.
100%.
One night, you know, we can have one instructor who just does a beautiful job at it, and another night where, you know, you have somebody who's more, let's say, better suited for like the hands-on skills, and then you have some instructors that are better at the, like, you know, didactic skills, some that are really good at both. So it helps to kind of, you know, wrap your head around it, but. Yeah, we started with the anatomy review, you know, what are arteries? What are capillaries? What are veins? You know, like, it's important to know that stuff, but it's not so much the bread and butter of the cardiac emergency stuff. It revolves around the idea of, like, what's the heart's job to pump?
Yep.
Right?
And when it's not doing the pumping, we have a problem.
Yeah, yeah. Not pumping tends to lead to bad outcomes.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple. It needs to keep going, which is convenient, because it can keep going on its own. It's the only part of the body that has automaticity.
Automaticity. Yep. It generates its own electrical signals.
Yep.
Look at you.
Yeah.
Automaticity. That was a good one.
But you know, that actually leads us into one of the unique thing about the heart, makes its own electrical signals, right? And like how that plays with how the heart works, because some of those cardiac emergencies aren't necessarily like a blockage. Sometimes they're an electrical problem.
Right.
Yes.
And you got a short in the system will throw off the heart.
Yes.
Now, Jonathan, help me. I'll, if my understanding is correct.
Okay.
There's certain parts of the heart that are closely linked to where the electrical system like starts from. Is that like where the signals originate? Is like the nodes, right?
Yeah. So you've got several different pacemaker sites in the heart. These are where electrical signals can be generated from. And so if we start at the top of the heart, we have the sinoatrial node, SA node.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and then we can come down into the AV node. And then we have the AV junction. And then we can even break it down. You have the bundle of His in there. You break it down into the ventricles and then the Purkinje fibers coming all the way down. And they each have their own different intrinsic rate that they will pump the heart at, or they will send electrical signals.
And then when you're looking at a 12 lead, and obviously we're not going to go so deep into like the electrical theory and the what is that? The triangle? Do you remember what the triangle thing is called? I got to look that up. There's a term for the guy who developed the idea of how to view the heart. But like, so a 12 lead is looking at views, right? It's seeing like, okay, this is what's these are the electrical signals that are firing within the heart. And this is the timing in which they're happening, right?
Right.
So the 12 lead or I'm not even gonna call it 12. The 12 lead's the prospeak, right? But the ECG, the electrocardiogram, that's looking at those nodes and how, in what sequence they are going in order, right? Or is it's showing the timing of when they're going off, like the S wave is a, you know, like a
yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So we're seeing, the different parts of the heart doing their job at the different points, looking at a 12 lead or looking at an ECG.
Okay.
So you have your atrial contraction, and you have your ventricular contraction, and And so those are denoted at different parts of that ECG.
And then different
in looking at it.
Yeah, different leads are showing you different parts of the heart working from different angles. Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Right, right. Yeah, so and some of those are not they are simulated views based upon data from other leads.
Yeah.
That you're seeing, right? You're not actually necessarily seeing those. You're just getting information from the multiple leads, and they're, you know, kind of to go to our experience with land navigation. They're triangulating different things within the heart and giving us a view that way. I'm not going to pretend to understand every aspect of how the ECG works.
Right, right.
But the point is that we can look at the different places in the heart and kind of make a determination of what's potentially going on based on what we're seeing in each of these leads.
Right. And that's, you know, from our standpoint on the BLS side, it's really just understanding that there is a higher level of, you know, the interpretation, if you will, like that's the term for being able to see those things, understand what they're doing. And then even like one of our instructors would talk about, like, you know, once you see these things enough, you can understand what's actually happening in three dimensional space with all these, like when you're seeing what's happening where and when. Mm-hmm. So it's giving us a graph of time and what's, you know, happening around the heart in time. Right. So it blows my mind that's, it's so cool that like somebody once figured out that like, hey, if I can connect some electrodes to the human body and then put them in different spots, I can see different activity happening on the heart at any one time and be able to then, you know, get so much data over time that they could diagnose problems happening from that information. It's crazy. It's amazing. Science is awesome.
The guy's name was Binthoven. Binthoven's triangle.
Yeah. Yeah. Binthoven. Is that the name of that, that St. Bernard? From the 90s.
Movies. Right. Well, when he dragged the table and chairs, that's when they figured out that this is really how we could figure things out.
That's hilarious.
I should have known that because I made the same joke in class none of the 20-year-olds understood what I was talking about. And I got really bummed.
unfortunately, my music and movie and pop culture references are going to the wayside as I talk to younger and younger folks, and it makes me pretty sad.
Welcome to the party, sir.
That's all I can say. I am there. I brought drinks for everybody.
But yeah, so the electrical system's important to understand, to know that the tools are available and that the diagnostic tools are there that can help you finding, you know, what's wrong with patients. That led us into the idea of perfusion and the lack thereof in certain circumstances, which is? What is the lack of perfusion? There's a term for it, Max. We should know this.
God damn it, we should.
Shock.
What?
Shock.
Shock is a lack of perfusion. Yeah, shock is a lack of perfusion.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So anytime you have a lack of perfusion, that's shock. And there's a bunch of different types of shock.
Different types of shock.
But like when your body isn't perfusing well enough, that's shock, right? So we have the different types of shock that can come from cardiac problems, cardiogenic. Being like the failure of the pump, right? Mm-hmm. Hypovolemic, like that's right. A cardiac failure, right? Like so that meaning.
Well,
so it's fluid loss, but like, is that generally talking about like a major bleed, or is it just not fluid that's flowing through?
So it's volume, fluid volume, but we could also see that. In not having enough oxygenated blood,
right?
You may not have enough volume, like fluid volume, in the body to have an adequate blood pressure, which allows us to perfuse all that tissue in the body. But it could also be a thing of not having enough red blood cells to carry oxygenated blood.
Sure.
Through that. Yeah. So in general though, hypovolemia, it's either a pump problem, or it's a fluid problem, or it's a container problem.
Right.
Gotcha.
So a good example, we might even get into at some point, is like an aortic aneurysm or mm-hmm. an aortic tear. Like that happening, which is just terrible. Yeah. And the only, from what I understand, the only option really that you can do for it is get them to the hospital as fast as humanly possible, which even then it's low chances. It's a funny fact. My mom had an aortic aneurysm on Christmas a couple years ago, and they caught it early. And,
oh, wow.
And they did an angioplasty with like these stents on the inside, and the stents mm-hmm. are ginormous because it's the aorta. Right. And I didn't understand it at the time. And now I'm like, holy shit. Like
that's yeah.
Yeah. Like they caught it before it had an aneurysm. Or no, it had an aneurysm. That's when it balloons out. But
it did not burst.
They caught it before it ruptured, which I'm like, oh man, that was the best Christmas present ever.
Yeah.
My mom was pissed. She's like, I'm going to be in the hospital for Christmas. This is, I have so much to do and I got to go. I have to make the prime rib and the mm-hmm. pearl onions with cream sauce. That's my favorite thing, by the way, for Christmas is prime rib and pearl onions and cream sauce, which my mom makes
for Christmas
every year. She was so disappointed. I'm like, Mom, it's fine.
You almost died.
This is the best Christmas ever. Like you're here.
Yes.
Like, where was I going with this? Oh, so, like if the aorta tears and they start getting blood loss, right. Like bleeds into the body,
right.
That is hypovolemia, right? Because all of a sudden you don't have enough blood in the container.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, like, and that's a cardiac emergency.
Right.
Yeah. So, if they're not having perfusion, that is essentially the downstream effects of the cardiac emergencies because the blood isn't getting where it needs to go. And you could have obstructive, like when it blocks the flow.
And that's really what we think of obstructive shock from, having an MI, right? Or when we have a STEMI, right? We have an occlusion somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then that's causing the downstream lack of perfusion. Mm-hmm. And, really it comes down to, like, for us, the treatment for these things is really oxygen.
Yeah.
You know, because it helps with perfusion. Like, they have reduced like circulation. Right. So putting more oxygen in helps, warmth,
mm-hmm.
All the typical, shock formula, like keep them warm.
Yep.
Positioning, if they're, hypotensive, laying them flat. If they have trouble breathing, don't do that.
But I mean, if we're thinking about treatment too, like just the 12 lead, I mean, it's a BLS skill. So getting a 12 lead on and getting that transmitted to the hospital is huge because the people that are going to intervene, they know where to send you. They know what you're coming in with.
Yep.
So the idea that 12 lead just being a BLS practice is invaluable.
Exactly.
Like the idea, oh no, I have to wait for that guy to do it. No, you should be doing it right now.
Yeah.
You should have already done it right now.
Yeah. And that, it's non-invasive, right? Like it's, you're getting the information that you need. And really all of that leading to rapid transport, right? Getting them to the place they need to go.
Yep. Lights and sirens, go fast.
Pain. We talked about chest pain a bunch. We talked about it in
pain don't hurt
in the opening section with chest pain. Like,
yeah.
What do we assume chest pain is?
Well, I mean, immediately you're going to go to a cardiac issue.
Right. And when are we going to assume that it's not cardiac issue?
If you don't see any of those symptoms, even then we're going to assume it's a cardiac issue until you get them on to the 12 lead and it says it's not a cardiac issue. The assumption is we're going with worst possible case, cardiac. Get them on the monitor.
And that's one of the differences between BLS and ALS is – I have a little bit more leeway to make some determinations as to whether I think this is cardiac chest pain or musculoskeletal chest pain.
Mm-hmm.
But as a BLS provider, you should err on the side of caution.
Yeah.
And follow if you don't have contraindications, you should follow your chest pain protocol, which is usually going to be your aspirin and your nitro, whether that's server, like agency administered nitro or
assisted
yeah. nitros. As long as you don't have any contraindications, you know?
Right.
But yeah, that's it. Like I said, it's one of the differences, right? Because I've got the ALS providers have that ability to interpret those those EKGs, ECGs, and but yeah, as a BLS provider, you should be erring on the side of caution and following down that treatment algorithm.
Right. So you know, with getting some of these signs and symptoms and seeing all this stuff, the interventions we have on the BLS side are, you know, we have some.
Sure,
they're maybe they're more limited than more advanced providers, but. Position seems to be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, are you uncomfortable? Well, let's see if we can at least make you more comfortable, like in either a Fowler or a semi-Fowler position. You know, if they're having trouble breathing, don't lay them down. I will always remember that because one of my first calls that I actually went out, you know, to go to, like they had there was an elderly woman with a nosebleed and mm-hmm. They had her laying on her back for a nosebleed.
Huh.
I'm like, I'm a new guy and I know this is stupid. Like, this was the nursing staff, the nursing home staff. They just left her in there to lay on her back with a nosebleed. I'm like, well, that's going to cause a problem real quick.
Yeah. Yeah. That's causing other problems, right? Like we're going to have vomiting.
Mm-hmm.
Stomach only handles so much blood before it comes back up.
So we got there and like, you know, first instinct, hey, darling, let's have you sit you up. Straight up, please. Like, cause let's not drown. That'd be great.
That it would be a plus.
Oxygen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The old O2.
Yeah.
Seems to be the big one. And then we start getting into, well, because oxygen is a drug. But what are the other two drugs that we have?
So we have oxygen. We have the nitroglycerin, like you said, aspirin as well.
Aspirin.
Aspirin's huge because it can be an immediate intervention at the start of things.
Yeah.
So it can intervene in that immediately.
And help, make the blood less sticky.
Yep.
I think is how you put it in a previous episode, Jonathan.
So it's an anti-aggregate, anti-platelet, right? Like, it doesn't, the saying was, oh, the poor man's blood thinner, but it doesn't actually do anything to thin the blood. What it does is it basically lubricates the red blood cells and doesn't allow them to clump together.
Mm-hmm.
And if we already have a blockage, it doesn't worsen that blockage, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully we give that aspirin and it allows, those red blood cells to just continue to slide by one another.
Yep.
So
we have nitroglycerin,
mm-hmm.
which is, mm-hmm. Indicated for chest pain, but that one works not just from, changing the blood, but it also vasodilates, so it alleviates some of the stress on the cardio cardio system, right?
The nitro doesn't change anything with the blood, but it does do that vasodilation, which is our big thing that we want out of it is
the lowers blood pressure,
right?
Yeah,
and helps with pain, which is
a plus.
Yeah,
right.
I'm sure the patients are happy with that.
I have no doubt.
Is there like, this is a totally non BLS question, Jonathan, like cause you guys can help with pain in general. Are there other pain medications that you can provide, on the ALS side for MI type stuff?
So, we've got a couple different options. It used to be the big go-to, morphine for cardiac chest pain,
mm-hmm.
Because it did some things with helping reduce preload and you know, and the same thing with the nitroglycerin and everything.
Oh, so it actually has a beneficial effect on the anatomy itself, not just from a pain analgesic standpoint.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right. And so, yeah, the nitroglycerin does the same thing. And one of the issues with the morphine, though, is because it does reduce that preload, we can tank somebody's blood pressure if we're not careful.
Yeah.
In the same way, we have to be cognizant of their blood pressure with nitro. We have to with morphine as well. So it has fallen to the wayside. The old mnemonic device that we used was Mona, MONA. All right, yeah. So morphine, oxygen, aspirin, nitro, and I think that's it. but anyway, we would give these medications in conjunction of one another, and they would hopefully alleviate some of the strain on the heart and some of the discomfort. Most places have gone away from using morphine for pain management.
Mm-hmm.
Most places are using fentanyl, and you don't get the benefit of reducing that preload like you would with the morphine, but the advantage to that is you also don't get you still can get some, but you don't get as much of a negative effect towards your blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the advantage of giving fentanyl. So, there's some ALS things that we can do to kind of reduce that. And the reality is if we make these patients more comfortable, so you guys are talking about positional comfort, giving them some oxygen, that sort of thing. If we can make these patients more comfortable and less stressed out, because their body's already under a lot of strain, the better outcome they're going to have. I had a medical director talking about like pain being like the negative effect that pain has on the mind, really can harm somebody's long-term outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So his whole thing was, hey, we are going to manage your discomfort and your pain. So hopefully you can have a better outcome.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a mindset that I've adopted from what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, like, why make their day worse?
Exactly. You know? They're like, already
freaking bad.
They're already having a horrible day.
Yeah, and people will tell you, like, I had a guy, not this past summer, but the previous summer, who definitely having an MI and went through all the chest pain protocol, and he got some fentanyl, and I mean, by the time we got him to the hospital, within 15 minutes, his pain had significantly subsided. He was at like an 8 or a 9, and he was down to like a 2 by the time we got him to the hospital, just from following chest pain protocol. And he's, as far as I'm aware, alive and well, sitting at home. And really the big thing was that early recognition. And just knowing he needed to get where he needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah.
So I was just, it's interesting because I know like we have that limited set, but
mm-hmm.
it's interesting to know what other protocols and things are out there for these patients as they, cause mm-hmm. like there's a million, there's a bunch of medications out there. Right. So from an intervention standpoint, those are our big interventions. Also with that, not necessarily a treatment, but, you know, getting them hooked up to your point, Max, the 12 lead or 4 lead or whatever it is, whatever you have available mm-hmm. to help kind of, you know, figure the problem out early.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have the ability, even on the BLS side, to help with that. We can't interpret it, but we have tools at our disposal, like to help get patients the care they need sooner. And to get more information to higher levels of care. That's really what mm-hmm. we're talking about there is like we're getting the best picture possible so that they can line up all the resources that they need.
Exactly.
As well as, you know, getting quick transport and a bit like, you know, activating ALS to get to that patient as quickly as possible, getting that patient to the hospital as quickly as possible. That is really, when it comes down to it, it seems the most definitive thing that as BLS providers we can do is get the patient there quickly.
Yep.
Like, like if you're suspecting cardiac problems,
move.
Like, let's not stay in play. Let's load and go. Let's get them there, because time to the cath lab, if they're having some sort of, you know, MI or blockage, that's the best way to help them.
Right.
Time is tissue.
So we have, that was kind of like the big things we went through. And then obviously, it bears mentioning that, like, if those things fail, like if we do not get there soon enough, if things progress quickly, obviously that leads to, you know, cardiac arrest.
Right.
You know, because we're talking about cardiac distress, really, but now we're in cardiac arrest. And of course, that leads to the discussion of resuscitation, CPR, you know, how effective that is, you know, and there's some, I remember in class, I was looking this up because they were going through a review of cardiac stuff and like talking about CPR. Did you know that I think the longest anybody has ever performed CPR, I think this happened, I got to look up the case, but basically with unassisted CPR, without hypothermia, I think it was something like 6 hours of somebody performing CPR without, like with a successful return to spontaneous circulation.
That's crazy.
That is crazy.
That's amazing.
Yes.
And a real, like, how do you go that, like, how do you believe that it's still going to work after that long? Or maybe there were some signs along the way that you were getting some other ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation, but.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll get ROSC and then you'll lose it and you play this game, but it's like, if you've gotten it once, if you're able to achieve ROSC, the one time, then, you know, we understand that there's still that possibility.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah. And then there's a ton of special circumstances, the hypothermia is the one that you mentioned. We have a bunch of other things that we might, consider, as far as like, all right, what is the underlying cause of the cardiac arrest? And things we might go down a path for to take care of, but yeah, that's a long, long time to do CPR.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And then the other big thing, like the big takeaway from this, well, yes, there's so many things that we can do to help, get information and help assess patients that are having cardiac emergencies. The early intervention with AEDs is huge.
Oh, yeah. Huge. Like, absolutely.
Because, electrical problems, which we were talking about before, and man, I was struggling my way through remembering the terminology or whatever. But the idea that electrical system going haywire or having a problem or being out of sync with the two shockable rhythms.
VTAC and VFib.
Yep.
Ventricular tachycardia and ventricular fibrillation.
Yep. So those exist in a large number of cardiac emergencies, you know, where a patient looks, I mean, I guess technically is that cardiac arrest or is it just a dysrhythmia? Like,
yes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
VTAC with a pulse is different than VTAC without a pulse, right? So that what we will say is, like having a pulse, kind of makes all the difference. Now, somebody with VTAC with a pulse, they still are having big issues, and they need to be that's a problem. But we start getting into ALS territory when we're dealing with those folks,
right?
When we don't have a pulse, we're in cardiac arrest. And then with VFib, you're not going to have a pulse anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you won't have a plus anyway. Yeah. So in that instance, we're both of those rhythms, we're in cardiac arrest and we're doing the CPR thing, and hopefully if the AED is able to recognize those rhythms, we're able to, you know, deliver a shock, get right back on the chest and continue that CPR till we get some extra help there to, you know, get a pulse back.
Right. Yeah. And so like the AED, I think, is like a modern day hero in terms of like cardiac emergencies. It's why they're everywhere. Right.
Yep.
So yeah, that was kind of like a big takeaway for me, and like, you know, just seeing how important those are. Well, obviously, recognizing things early, getting them there fast. If things go bad, getting right on the chest, keeping the perfusion going, doing the getting the AED involved early. Right. Those are the things that we're really
The amazing thing about the AED is they've made it so that a child can operate it. Like,
yes,
they want to say dumbed it down. But they really have made it so that anyone, as long as you can use a zipper and you're able to read, you can apply that effectively.
And the only reason you need to learn to use the zipper is because it's usually in a nice little case that you have to unzip.
Yes, exactly.
That's the hardest part, is getting it unzipped to open it up and hit the button.
But I mean, everything else is laid out so simply for you. I think if there hasn't already been a commendation to the people that designed that and the way they designed it, because the thought that went into it was very good, because they could have went way over complicated and they didn't.
It's definitely one of those things that if I had to pick a piece of medical gear that's like hyper expensive to have, that would be the one that I think potentially could have the most benefit, because early defibrillation is super important. Mm-hmm. And when people are in cardiac arrest, they need their chest pumped on and blood circulated, and they need electricity early.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the stuff that saves lives. And the only way to the point of like AEDs becoming more prolific, and I mean, they're everywhere, Walmart, and they're, you know, any of your big box stores, a lot of your different municipal buildings have them in them. Every police car in America probably has one in it now. They put a grant out for doing stuff like that. So it's really one of the most beneficial things that we've got as far as a medical device out there.
Yep.
So
totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's great to know that, like, you know, I think just when we were kids, those didn't exist.
Nope.
Like, mm-hmm. I mean, like defibrillation existed, but like, the idea of a small, portable, like, you know, consumer
layperson
able to use tool. That's great. Yeah. I think that's another testament to kind of not only just science, but also, you know, industry, you know, kind of where, like, hey, we can solve a problem for this and we can go help some people.
Yeah.
Is create this tool and put it at a, you know, at a price point and develop it so that it can be in a lot of places. And I'm sure the numbers speak for it too,
for sure.
And hey, if you're out there listening or watching, here's something I want to encourage you to do. Maybe you're still on, maybe at this episode, or you stumbled upon this episode and this is the first time you're listening, but maybe you've been following along the whole time and you're still on the fence about going to EMT school, or you don't really want to go to EMT school. Go get CPR training.
Yes. Yes.
That is, you absolutely can save a life with CPR, because you're probably going to be around when somebody needs CPR, and just being trained is absolutely the benefit, because I need somebody to do quality compressions while I'm being notified and while I'm responding, and then while I'm trying to get all my equipment out, I need somebody that is trained and able to do that. And so the more people we have trained and do that, the more lives we can potentially save.
100%.
Yep. So,
that's kind of the big picture of our cardiac emergencies, right? There's a bunch of different reasons why, but really it comes down to early intervention, you know, or early recognition. That's the big one. You know, using the tools and the drugs that we may have at our disposal, like the aspirin, the nitro, and getting them to higher levels of care as quickly as possible. I mean, I know this kind of dumbs it down and really oversimplifies it, but like that's really what it comes down to is, you know, do what you can, get them to where they'll get definitive care as fast as possible. Yes. And then, you know, get connected or call for ALS early. You could always tell them to cancel. Like, you know, if it looks like it's a cardiac thing, you know, what's the term? Over ask for resources. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you could always send them away.
Exactly.
You know, get the higher levels of care to that patient as early as possible. That's like the, you know, the reason why ALS is a thing, like, you know, why they have that giant, like, it's called a heart monitor. Like that's why.
Yeah.
Like they call them for the heart stuff.
Yes.
And then get them to the hospital as quickly as possible.
100%.
But yeah, so cardiac emergencies. Now, there's a tool that we use.
Yes.
When it comes to cardiac emergencies. Sometimes, well, you know, we put on 12 leads. Those go all over the parts of the body. But if things progress, if we get to a point where we need to start giving CPR, if we need to resuscitate, that's where we start getting a little bit more. We disregard the.
Hey, we gotta get them exposed.
Yeah, you gotta get them exposed, right?
We gotta get the chest out so we can put those defib pads on them.
We disregard the modesty, right? It's saving a life over modesty.
Ditch modesty in favor of saving their life.
Cut their clothes off.
Yes.
Get the pads on.
Yes.
Start chest compressions. It doesn't matter if they're in the cereal aisle of Walmart, right?
Exactly.
Like we gotta do what we gotta do, and we start getting on that chest and we start getting that AED on early. So being that this is a cardiac, you know, related thing, we have decided that this week is what tool?
Well, let's start with the sponsor of this week's Tools of the Trade.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the special thing because we have a sponsor for this week's Tool of the Trade, which is X-Shear. And they make really great shears.
They do indeed. Which
Max is going to tell us about shears.
Yes. So this week's Tool of Trade is EMS shears. So a little bit of history. So the precursors to the modern trauma shears were invented by a guy named Preston Burham in 1956. And the main innovation was the lower blade being flat. That way they could slip it underneath clothing or bandages to be able to cut safer. And there were other innovations by a guy named Dr. Sam Sheinberg, who was the founder of SAM Medical.
The Sam Medical. Like Sam splints and Sam tourniquets and Sam, all the other Sam.
All the other Sam
stuff. There's a lot of Sam stuff. But
the main thing was he realized that they needed a safer way for cutting scissors. And that where it's kind of where the blunted tip came out.
Which I'm sure is really like, that's probably the best part about trauma shears.
And then going a little further on, you know, by the 1970s, that's when you started seeing rescue shears, you know, being a tool that's being used by EMS services in general.
Mm-hmm.
Through the 2000s, there's a lot of added features that were put onto them, like O2 wrenches, so that you could open up a bottle of O2, hook knives for seatbelts and things like that, and the ability to fold up. Some of them have that feature. That way they're easier carried.
Mm-hmm.
But the main question is, like, why do we need shears?
And well, obviously we need shears because, you know, when kids are on the back of the ambulance and like it's Christmas time, you would use them to you fold pieces of paper and then you cut out little angles on them and then you open it up and it's like it's like a snowflake.
Or you're home and every pair of scissors you've ever bought has just evaporated because that's what happens. And you have to pull out your $60 pair of shears so someone can cut open a container of food.
Right.
I mean, that's really what they're there for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You guys are ridiculous.
We are. So
I use them to cut when I lost a lot of weight and I needed to make my belt shorter. I used trauma shears to make my belt shorter.
I bet you did.
You can use them to cut pennies.
You like can. I've done that.
When you need to just have half a cent,
right?
You can cut the pennies off. No, like, so... No.
So seriously though, so you may have to do, I mean, yes, you're going to be cutting, say, fabric of shirts, pants. What about belts? You may have to cut off someone's boot. So having a pair of shears that is heavy duty enough to be able to go through those materials mm-hmm. easily. And
right.
I got to use my shears finally, real world, in the back of the ambulance. And I was using a pair of cheaper disposable shears mm-hmm. and struggling with it. And then I realized, you're an idiot. You have a pair of awesome shears that are sitting in your pocket. And what I found the main thing for me was I was able to remove the clothing without disturbing the patient's limbs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Like for me, it was immediate, like, oh, here we go. The ability to not put more pain into that patient by being able to cut cleanly through the clothing and all the materials that were covering the injury, that was like a bright shining neon flashing light.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, you have all these different features that they come with and the better materials. But when it comes down to it, the ability to expose those injuries and on top of that, not cause the patient more pain
or undue stress
or under stress. That for me is really the really key thing for these things.
Yeah.
My key takeaway.
So trauma shears, I think they're ubiquitous with the idea of sure. EMTs. Like a lot of the people that I see, usually they'll have them hanging from either their belt or the radio strap. Like they'll have that mm-hmm. radio sack. What? Yep. I don't even know. We said it in a previous episode. I can't even remember what the thing's called.
Cradle.
Radio cradle. Sure. Usually they'll have a pair of shears on that.
Yeah.
Or they'll be in a pocket or they're everywhere. Like you need them easily accessible. Sure. They're super important to have when you need them.
Yes.
It's like having a pocket knife, right? Like you mm-hmm. need a pocket knife because there are situations that come into play, like not necessarily for EMT stuff, but I meant in general, like use it as a tool.
Yeah.
Like, and you need it immediately available. When you need the trauma shears, you need them right now. Like right yes. now, right now.
Yeah.
So we need to get stuff out of the way, mm-hmm. assess the patient, right? This is why, and hearing your story, and Jonathan, you were saying about how these particular shears have been working really well. I know this is going to sound like an ad. I swear this isn't necessarily an ad. We've just had some hands-on experience in using these particular trauma shears lately, and they work really, really well. Like, they're like better than, and I'm not putting any brands down, but quality wise, this is us just saying what we have found in our brief experience is that having shears that are made of a tougher, higher quality metal,
yep,
they keep an edge better, they cut better, you can put more force in them, you can cut things better with them, and they outperform. Like I have a pair of no-name shears here. They're stamped metal, probably made of some stainless thing. Do they work? Maybe for a little while, but I've had many pairs of shears that after you put too much pressure in them, the two blades no longer touch each other anymore and they'll have a gap in there and then you got to throw them away because it only costs $6 for it. It's great to stage them. You can put them everywhere and hopefully, you know, they'll work when you need them. But
the idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had a side-by-side comparison within seconds of each other, and it was night and day.
Yeah.
I've been impressed with the X years up to this point, and we'll continue to use them and try them out. Very, very glad to have them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They've been really kind to us, and I just, you know, aside from them, you know, sending these to us and being just awesome people, I got to meet them at EMS World Expo, and you know, I got to meet the guy. I got to meet Wes. Wes is a longtime paramedic, flight medic, I believe, and like has put a lot of time and effort into understanding, like, you know, figuring out what do we as emergency medical professionals need in shears, right? Like we've talked mm-hmm. about that. Then I got to meet Nate, the guy who he brought on to help him develop the holsters that they work with.
Yeah.
So I'm also a big fan of not only just having the good tool, but like how that thing is then staged or put on you. So the fact that two things can work together to have an immediately accessible tool, I think is great.
Yep.
And it's not to say that I think this is the only option. There are other, I'm sure there are other great tools out there. get like you, the thing is put the time and the effort into and the money into getting something that works really well for you, not just the thing that, you know, is cheap, you know, because I think you can find some really good solutions out there and there's people making really good stuff. So, that's my 2 cents.
Yeah. The reality is it's shears are a tool that we need to do our jobs. And no matter which way you go, the most of my career, I've used the inexpensive, more or less consumable shears.
Yeah. One time, throw them away when you're done.
Yeah. You know, you might get a couple, if you don't get them bloody or gross, you might get a couple uses out of them, but after a couple uses, they just don't cut as well. So it's nice that the market has, heard the call of providers and started to make some different options for us out there. So whatever you get, make sure you buy something that's going to last you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's going to work for you.
Yeah.
One last thing, sorry. There are other sizes too.
Yeah.
Like some people make different size shears, and the fact that you can find some companies that are making smaller ones with associated holsters, like things that are more easily carryable on you at all times, because if it's not on you when you need it, it's not going to be there.
Like 100%.
You should really have solutions that allow that thing to be as close or as accessible as possible. But yeah, the sizing I think is a cool thing too.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. But shears. We've been waiting on this one for a while. We wanted to find the right episode to talk about it on. We felt that cardiac emergencies are ones where shears will pop out.
Yeah.
And they're a really good tool to make sure that you have, and you're probably gonna wind up using your shears.
Yeah, at least.
But yeah. So that's our tool of the trade this week, sponsored by X-Shear. And that leads us to our last regular segment, which is our student tip of the week.
Student tip of the week. Yeah. So as we're talking about cardiac chest pain and we're talking about time as tissue, the big tip I have for everybody out there is when you're dispatched to a call for any sort of chest pain, you should have a goal in your mind of having a 12 lead or an ECG completed within 5 minutes of being on scene, of marking on scene. That means in your cardiac monitor with you into the scene. That means, somebody's doing an interview while the other person's hooking up the electrodes and the leads to the patient. In that same vein of chest pain, before we start moving people to the stretcher or getting them and having them walk, let's go ahead and do that 12 lead and get that done, because we don't want to put any undue stress on our chest pain people. We want to make sure that this is not an MI before we start moving them around. We want to keep them as calm and as stress-free as possible. They're already under a lot of stress, not feeling great. So basically, don't make your chest pain patient walk down a flight of stairs. Yeah.
Or climb a hill.
Right.
Or climb a hill. Many a times that's happened and you turn around to find out, oh man, they're having the big one. So, aim for that goal of having an ECG done within 5 minutes. And then if you need to send it somewhere, go ahead and send it to the appropriate place.
Nice. Well, thank you, sir, for our tip of the week. I will certainly remember that. I will get that 12 lead on early. But yes. So that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Cardiac Emergencies Kickstart My Heart.
Exactly.
Yep. And then stay tuned for next week, where we will be talking about what?
Diabetes.
The diabetes.
I'm Wilford Brimley, and I've got diabetes.
Yep. The Wilford Brimley week. The episode title is named Pour Some Sugar Down Me, for any of those like low blood sugar types out there. I can't help it. I got to keep doing the song names.
Again, buy a monster, send your requests in.
Stop it. But thank you all for joining us. We're having such a great time, you know, going through this journey, and I hope you're enjoying it too. But yeah, thanks for taking the ride with us, and we'll see you next time on the ride along. This podcast is for educational and storytelling purposes only. It is not medical advice or official EMT training. Always follow your accredited instructors and local protocols. Heartbeats racing.